Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name's Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic.
Robert.
And Wayne encouraged you not to leave because he knows how easily distracted I can be. So appreciate that. And has it been a great workshop or what?
Yeah.
Let's give him a hand. You know, I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak, in particular Bill, and I'm honored that I can do that. And I like to say at times that my life is better because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm better at life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I also think that my life is better because of the Atlanta Men's Workshop, and I'm better at life because of the Atlanta Men's Workshop. So I'm certainly pleased to be here. I'm honored to be here and share a little bit of my story. And, of course, it's titled The Sunday Spiritual Renewal Meeting. So we'll see if spirits renewed. That's certainly my hope. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what happened to me. And one question I want to ask before we get going, it's sort of been asked before, but how many people are here in their very first year of Alcoholics Anonymous? If you'll raise your hand. Great. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got a similar question, same type response. Is there anyone here in their last year of Alcoholics Anonymous? Every now and then, I fool people. They raise their hand. They get a little antsy. They want to participate. But I can ask that question because I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous April 10, 2001. That's my sobriety date. And I say I came back because that wasn't my first time here. And for the better part of 9 years, I was in my first year of Alcoholics Anonymous and my last year of Alcoholics Anonymous at the same time, and I didn't realize it. And I bring this up because when I look at some of the meetings that went on last night, there was a meeting on relapse and reentry, and it made me think a little bit about what happened to me. And so I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe not like your home group, but I'd go to meetings where I'd hear things read like, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, see, I didn't know what you guys had. I'd hear things like, meeting makers make it. And I made a lot of meetings, but I did not have a spiritual experience as a result of making meetings. I had a spiritual experience as a result of taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd hear other things like, if you can make it till midnight, you're a winner. Well, at this time of day, I'd be thinking 14 and a half hours. I'll never make that long. But even if it's an 8 o'clock at night meeting, and I'm thinking it's just another 3.5 hours, and my knuckles are white, my teeth are clenched. See, I was an untreated alcoholic. I could not make it through the day, and I just could not stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous until I got here and did the things that you do. And so, you know, I got to that point, and I'll get to it in my story, but I got to that point where things changed. And I came with a level of desperation that was different. It was different than anything else that had ever happened. And what's that one thing that happened April 10th that has largely kept me happy, joyous, and free from that time to this date? There's one thing that happened that made all the difference in the world, and I can boil it down to one word. And it's sponsorship. I got a sponsor. And this was a guy that was God-conscious. This was a guy that was God-reliant. This was a guy that was God-dependent. This was a guy that talked about getting in touch with a higher power and relying on that through the ups and downs of life. And, you know, I'd never done that. And so this guy, he talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll get into this a bit more. But he didn't tell me what to do. He showed me what to do. And I'm not the kind of guy that quotes the big book. However, on page 44, it says, if when you want to stop drinking, you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Only a spiritual experience. See, I needed that. I didn't know I needed that, but I needed that. And an illness, what kind of illness is this? You know, when I think about illnesses, I think about, you know, I got strep throat a couple years ago, and they give me a bottle of pills, and if I take them as directed, it knocks the strep throat out. So I come in here and I'm thinking maybe if there's some kind of spirituality pill, I can take that. Well, I probably want to take two or three because I know the kind of guy I am. But then the other kind of illness I've had, I had an appendicitis. This was 25 years ago. I go in the hospital, they cut it out, they let me leave the hospital, and I'm done. I'm through. There's no more meetings, no more follow-up, no big book to study. I think about that kind of illness. And then I get here and I'm thinking, what kind of illness is this? It's a spiritual malady. It's different from anything I'd really heard of. I don't know that I bought into it at first. And who wants to come in here and admit that they're powerless? To turn their will and their life over the care of God. To make an inventory. To have to make amends to virtually everyone you know. I mean, that was not the kind of illness I wanted at that point. And then to top it off, to reach out your hand to the sick and suffering alcoholic, man or woman, that shows up at the door as the process by which you get to stay sober. See, that did not sound like a good idea to me then, but it's a great thing now. It's an easy process. It's simple, maybe not easy, but it's a process that once I got a sponsor, I could do that. You know, it talks about following a path. It talks about taking steps. We talk about reading the book. And see, the book wasn't that hard to read, and the steps weren't that hard to take, and the path wasn't that hard to follow once I got a sponsor. But do it on my own, I just could not do it. I just could not do it. So I'm not one of those guys that has one white chip. I love hearing the stories about guys who have one white chip. But I think the fact that we had meetings last night on sponsorship, getting, using, and being, that was key in my recovery. We talk about relapse or reentry. That's what happened to me. I thought maybe that's a message that I should at least bring that up. And so if you come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me assure you, you can get here, get a sponsor, take the 12 steps, have a spiritual awakening, and you really don't have to drink. You really, really don't. So, I was born in Atlanta. My parents were married. They stayed married until my mom died. I had a great childhood. You know, I'd have said there was things that were wrong. For the most part, my parents offered me all the things that I needed, most of the stuff that I wanted. Had good educational opportunities, benefit of private school education. I had good religious training, shown right from wrong. My mom was probably the greater disciplinarian, and she disciplined maybe the way that was appropriate in the late 50s and early 60s. You know, I probably got more spankings than kids get these days. But, you know, I was really shown right from wrong. And my dad was the kind of guy that he was described as honest as the day is long. Honest as the day is long. And those are the type of things that I was taught. I was pointed out spiritual principles. And yet I can remember as a little kid, I did stuff. I'd hang out with guys. I can remember we were going to a convenience store. I was probably 10, something like that. And people are stealing candy bars. And so I was a little anxious about that. I was a little scared, but I wanted to hang out with those guys. Before I knew it, I stole that candy bar. I'm out talking with the guys, and, you know, steal something the first time, you get a little anxious, steal it two or three times, and you overcome that kind of stuff. Next thing you know, I'm pretty willing to maybe steal something or tell a little lie. And, you know, there's one thing that did happen as a child, though. I mean, I was an early adolescent, and was between Thanksgiving and Christmas. The governor had allowed a set of prisoners to go on furlough, and one of these prisoners was not really prepared to go on furlough. And my dad was out of town, my mom and my brother and I were at home, and this guy that had been let on furlough broke into the house, and he came into the house. My mom had heard him breaking in. My dad was out of town. There wasn't a car in the driveway, and she flipped the lights on and off. The guy knew that there was people in the house, and fortunately, my mom called the police. The guy pushed his way in a window. He grabbed my mom. My brother and I were asleep in a bedroom. And he grabbed my mom, was dragging her back to the bedroom. She was saying, there's money available. There's presents available. And I think he was there to rape my mother. And right as it was about time for him to push her back through a bedroom door, there was a knock. And it was the police. And this guy didn't know what to do. He ran out and jumped out the back door. But I can tell you what happened to our family that day. Our family was disrupted. We moved out of that house that night, moved into an apartment, stayed in a hotel the first night, then into an apartment. And my mom was scared to death. As a little kid, I didn't realize this, but I was scared too. We didn't go to counseling, and I was scared, I was angry. We weren't in the house we grew up with the creek in the front yard and all that kind of stuff. And little did I know that it's stuff like fears and angers that drive you towards alcoholism. These are things that I held on to for a long, long time. This all comes out the fourth step. You know, it really wasn't too long, probably about 2 years, that I can remember. I was sitting in front of the high school gym. I grew up sort of in the Chestane Park area and went to school near there. And I was sitting there with my buddy Rex. And I'll never forget, these guys from Roswell drove up. It's the McClellan brothers. And these are guys that they were cool. They drove this Volkswagen van. They played in a band. You know, they were the kind of guys you looked up to. One was 16, one was 17. I was 15, I think Rex was 16, and they pulled up in that van, and they opened that door, and they said, man, you guys want to go have a couple of beers. And see, we looked up to those guys. These are guys, they talked about all sorts of stuff. They talked about going out with women. They talked about having sex with women. Well, see, I'd had sex before. It had always been menage a uno. But these were guys we looked up to. When they invited us into that, I'm thinking, yes, we'll go out, I'll have a couple of beers. I'd remember seeing my dad. He'd have a couple of beers, he'd have a couple of drinks at home, read the newspaper, go to bed, go to work the next day. So I'm thinking I'm going to jump in there, have a couple of beers. One of the things that makes me alcoholic happen that night, I'm thinking I'm going to get in that van with my buddy Rex, with the McClellan brothers, drive around, have a couple of beers. I end up having 6 or 8. I drank more than I thought I was going to. I lost control of the amount that I was taking. And I didn't realize that that was going to happen. Moreover, what else happened is when I took those drinks, I don't know that I felt as a kid any more different than any other kid, but I knew that I felt a little bit different. My hair is red, sort of this weird color. I wore glasses until I got contacts. I wasn't always as good in sports as everybody else. I might have been good in schoolwork, but I wasn't as good in sports. And so sometimes I felt on the outside. But man, when I drank that beer, it was like, oh, it was wonderful. I was able to talk about things. I mean, I really didn't realize it'd been like I'd been out of breath my whole life, you know? It was wonderful. And it wasn't long before I was drinking again, you know, probably the next weekend. So the first time I drink more than I'm thinking I'm going to drink. And on top of that, I've got this desire. Now, was I born an alcoholic? I don't know. But I can tell you on that day, an alcoholic was born. Because I started drinking on the weekends. The drinking age was 18 in those days. It was really easy to access alcohol. People had older brothers. You could get fake IDs pretty easily. There wasn't the level of concern about drinking. So we started drinking on a regular basis. And, you know, it wasn't too long before I was out with another guy I hang out with and drank with. This guy, Drew, and we're driving around in his Triumph TR6. I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was May. I was probably 16 years old then. And we're driving along, and he says, "Robert, reach in the glove compartment." I was in the passenger seat. I opened it up, and he had this bag of weed. And so I pulled it out, and he says, "Open it up." And I opened it up, and one of these Ziploc bags like you would get now. It's one of those old sandwich bags that people, 8 or 10 people, have licked on. And, you know, it had the seeds and the stems. And when you smoked it, it popped and burned your shirt and all that kind of stuff. I see you guys know what I'm talking about. And so, you know, we smoked some of that pot, and I don't know that I fell in love with marijuana. I know that it enhanced the effect of alcohol. So I got to where I was drinking that, smoking that on a regular basis when I was out drinking and things like that. And you start doing those kind of things, and this was right after Woodstock. Post-Woodstock years, lots of stuff going on around Atlanta and throughout the country. And I ended up meeting this girl, Sharon. And Sharon was sort of a wild girl, but I can remember she invited me over to her house. I'd been dating her a little while. And she invited me back to her bedroom, and I thought, this sounds good. Her parents were up in the front of the house. We're in the back bedroom, the back of the house. She shuts the door. Looking pretty good to me. Then she goes through this ritual that I'd read about, that I'd seen in the newspaper, maybe in movies. She pulls out this mirror, and she dumps this white powder, and she chops it all up, pushes it into a couple rails, and pulls out this straw, and she looks at me and says, "Robert, if you'll snort this stuff with me, I'll let you feel my boobs." Well, you can imagine what happened. I drank and did drugs for another 25 years. The outcome of all that. And you know, here's where many alcoholics, when they're telling their story, they interject an apology about talking about drugs during their story. And I believe 100% signals the purpose. The reason I'm alcoholic is because once I start drinking, I can't control the amount that I drink. I believe what the doctor's opinion says, and I identify as an alcoholic. That phenomenon of craving hits me. And, you know, while I'm up here, it's something that happens with me with only alcohol. I have this special relationship with alcohol. Once I start drinking it, no telling what's going to happen. And while I'm up here, and here's a good example. While I'm up here, I may drink half this bottle of water. I may drink the whole bottle of water. But I can tell you what's not going to happen. So I'm not going to go out and buy a couple of cases of water and check into a hotel. And so when I'm speaking about a little intermittent drug use between my drinking, I certainly don't know that apology is necessary, but I really do believe in signals of purpose. And there's a point in me telling this part of the story when it gets around to step 9. So I'm drinking and going through high school, and I'm running into a few problems here and there, problems at home. Some of the drinking leads to getting sick, vomiting, throwing up, all that kind of stuff, the kinds of things that alcoholics have, but they just push through it, you know, and I don't realize that this is alcoholism developing in me. But I can remember I did have some experiences that sort of raised the red flag. I was to head with a friend of mine, David, from Athens, Georgia, from a baseball game we're in, and go down to Jekyll Island. We're supposed to be meeting some of our high school friends for some club that we're to meet at down there, and supposed to meet down there Friday night. So we left the baseball game about 5 o'clock when the game was over. He was 18, I was 17, we're in my family car, we took off, we had a cooler beer, some sandwiches, all that kind of stuff. So we're driving down to Jekyll Island, heading down 75, and on the way down there, David says to me, "Robert, why don't you let me drive?" And I think maybe he thought I'd been drinking too much, I'm not really certain, but anyway, I thought, it sounds good to me, so I let him drive. So he's driving, and he's drinking, and I'm drinking, and we're having a good time, we're laughing, telling jokes, listening to music, and all of a sudden, the blue lights come on. Evidently, David was not as good a drunk driver as he thought he was. And we got pulled over. We're in Camden County, and if you're familiar with the geography of Georgia, you would probably wonder how we got into Camden County, because it's over on the other side of Glenn County, which is where Jekyll Island is. It's south of it. So we had missed the mark a little bit. We got pulled over by the police. He gets thrown in jail for driving under the influence, and I get thrown in jail for public drunkenness. And so we've got to talk to somebody to get us out of jail, and they say, "Who's going to bail you out?" And David looks at me and says, "My parents are out of town." So it means I'm going to have to call my dad. And my dad was expecting a phone call from me from Jekyll Island, Georgia, saying we're down here safe and sound. Instead, he gets a call from me from the Camden County Courthouse saying I've been arrested. And he was upset, and I could hear the anger. I mean, he wasn't screaming or yelling, but you could tell he had counted to 10 and died. He said, "I'll send that money down there, but we want you and David here at the house at 5 p.m. Sunday. You're supposed to be through there at noon, be here at 5. So we drive back to Atlanta. We get there at 5 o'clock, and when we pull up, David's parents and my parents are sitting there waiting on us. And they sort of read us a riot act. They talk us about drinking, and even worse, drinking and driving. You could have killed somebody. And this story is important. If you watch David and me drink, we were knocking them down one after the other. When David and I would go out drinking, partying, you couldn't tell one of us from the other. David got that warning from his family, and he's the kind of drinker the Big Book describes as a hard drinker. Given sufficient reason, given sufficient motivation from a doctor, lawyer, parents, judge, he can moderate or quit. David promised to quit, and he did. You know, I made those very same promises. The next weekend, I'm out there drinking again. See, I am powerless against that first drink, and I didn't understand it then. And I don't know if it's just because I didn't care what my parents said, but when I made that promise, I meant it. Going to jail was no fun. That was not the only time I went to jail in high school. You know, I got out of high school, and I went to a four-year school up in North Carolina, and I sped through that school in 60 months, and I missed a few classes here and there, but you know, I hear people ask, or they say, "I just can't understand how anyone can get through college that's an active alcoholic." Well, I was able to get through college, and the reason was is I could take tests. If you give me a written test, and I could do pretty good on a written test because I could come up with some good stuff. If you give a multiple choice test, that's even easier. You can sort of do that like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire 50-50, knock a couple of them out, and I can do that kind of test. But you give me an oral test, and I've got three or four guys up here talking, and I got the other guy outnumbered. I could take an oral test. But you know, I got out of college, and I found out there was one test I could not pass. That was a field sobriety test. And I had the opportunity to take that test three times in my mid-20s. And I'm not making light of DUIs, and it's certainly wrong. Probably if I went around the room here, there's people whose lives have been tremendously impacted because people who die because of drinking and driving. But anyway, I had three of them in a several-month period, and I was making some decent money, and so I did the thing you naturally do. I got an attorney. And the attorney told me, he says, "Robert, let me do all the talking." I said, "That's what I'm paying you for." And of course I let him do all the talking. He says, "However, if the judge asks you a question I want you to answer, I'll give you the nod." And so we actually met in the judge's chambers. This guy had a good relationship with the judge. We're in the judge's chambers, and he's looking through these three tickets from DUIs. One was involved in an accident, so there's probably some other charges. And he had this big old tractor feed printout like he used to have in the 80s. And there was these other arrests, most of them alcohol-related. And he said, "Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" And I thought, no, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating is what the real problem was. But I didn't say that. And you know, but the truth was, there's objective evidence that I had problems with alcohol. They had taken tests. I'd been over the limit. And what a great follow-up question would have been is, maybe you should get some help. Maybe you should go to treatment. Maybe you should go to AA. There's a lot of things that could have been said after that question, but it wasn't said because the fix was in. I'd paid the attorney, and I don't know exactly how he strained it all out, but, you know, I dodged the bullet. Did not have to have any consequences that were that severe, and consequences seem to not affect me. It doesn't affect my drinking anyway. May affect me short-term, may affect me financially, may affect me with relationships, but they don't seem to stop my drinking. So during this time, I was doing Quaaludes, cocaine, that sort of lifestyle of stuff going on with people my age in Buckhead, and it was about to kill me. And I can remember I got up on a Sunday morning about this time, maybe a little later, and I felt bad. I'd been out with my brother. We had tied one on. It had been going on for a couple of days, really, and I said, I have got to quit this. It's going to kill me. And, you know, I'd grown up going to church, and I thought, maybe I should go to church. And so I went to church, and I tried to talk to some people, and I found out that I could kick that Quaalude and cocaine habit, and it's pretty easy. And here's what you do if you got a habit like that. If you go out and buy a fifth a day of old granddad, you can kick that other stuff, you know? And drinking's socially acceptable, and so I did that. But I started going to church. I was thinking, maybe this is going to help me. And there was certainly some positive benefit of that. There's people there that care, people there that talk to me, but they did not have a solution for alcoholism. I kept drinking, but while I was there, I met my first wife. There's a subtle piece of information there, my first wife, Teresa, and she is a wonderful woman. I still care about her. And, you know, we fell in love, we got married. And when a woman like that meets a man like me, it's the end of all her troubles. It's the front end of all her troubles, is what it is. Because here's what happens with a guy like me. I'm the kind of guy that on a night like tonight, I would say, honey, I'm going to be home about 7 o'clock. I'm going to meet Bill. We're going to have a couple of beers and watch the North Carolina-Kentucky game. A couple of beers, I'll be home at 7 for dinner. Now, what I did not understand at that point is I didn't understand what you guys ended up talking to me about this whole phenomenon of craving thing. So I meet Bill. We have a couple of beers. The game's really good. I maybe throw in a few shots. I see some other guys I know. I meet new people I hadn't met yet. Before I know it, the basketball games are over. We're just watching ESPN. It's 10:30, 11 o'clock, and my wife is at home. She's sad and she's angry. There's a variety of emotions she's going through, and I'm just having a good time. By that time, I'm thinking she's already put the dinner away, and I've already missed the mark, and I'm drinking, and so I'm probably going to stay out late. Might miss work the next day. And here's the kind of guy I am. I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say, my drinking really isn't hurting anybody. But you know, you go ask my wife, you ask my parents, you ask my brother, you ask people I work for, you ask people that I employed. You ask virtually anyone that knows me, except the people I'm drinking with, and I'm just leaving a mess behind me. You know, I'm building that step eight list right then and there. And I don't even see that kind of thing. But you know, there'd be periods of sobriety, I'd run into some kind of trouble, I'd put my foot down saying, I gotta quit, I gotta do this kind of thing. And this happened sort of at one particular time in my life. We were thinking about having children and want to get pregnant. Our friends were having kids, and so we were going to try and have kids, and we were having problems. My wife went to the doctor, and she was being checked out, see if there's any reason why she couldn't get pregnant. And they said, your husband needs to go to the doctor, too. So I go to the doctor, and meanwhile, they diagnose this thing that's going to require a surgery. It's an abdominal surgery. It doesn't sound like too big a deal. It's an elective. It's a couple months away. I want to be a good husband, I want to stay healthy and be a good parent, all that kind of stuff, so I'm willing to have that surgery. But it gets about a week out, and they're going to do some blood work and some of the pre-operation information that I need, and I start thinking about this, and I think an abdominal incision could be painful, and I asked the doctor about that. He says, oh yes, it is going to be painful. And I said, well, what are we going to do about that? He says, well, when we discharge from the hospital, we'll send you home, and there's an appropriate treatment for that, and it's called narcotic medication. And I was okay with that, too. And what happened to me is I came up with this plan. And now, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you raise your hand a little earlier, if you're new and you have a plan, what you need to do is tell us your plan. Because if you've got a plan, it's probably a doozy. And here was my plan. My wife didn't like my drinking, but I traveled at that point in my career. And so when I was on the road, I could drink the way that I wanted to. And when I was in town, the idea is maybe I'll just pop a few of these pills, because though the bottle said take 2 every 4 hours, I found if you took 4 every 2 hours or even more, I'd get a little bit of ease and comfort from that. And so I started popping these pills in town, but I found out that I ran out prematurely. So I told my family physician, and he sympathized with the level of pain that an abdominal incision can cause, and that wasn't quite enough, so I told a couple other new physician friends, and they sympathized with this pain, and so I was able to sort of have this flow such that I could pop a few pills and drink when I'm on the road, and you know, I was sort of trying to get away with it. However, there is a fallacy in this. There was a time or two when my wife would come in, and though I wasn't smelling of alcohol, I was laying on the floor, unconscious. And so she knew something was wrong. But there's a couple fallacies to this plan. One is, I noticed on the pill bottle that it said, do not take with alcohol, and I thought maybe alcohol will improve the effect of these pills. And like before, I would have a couple of beers when I'd wash this stuff down. I didn't realize that what would happen to me is when I got home after taking those pills and they sort of started kicking in, that I was going to get really thirsty. And I was thirsty for more beer, some liquor. So I'd rummage through the house. I'd look in the fridge. Maybe there was some milk that needed to be bought, and I'd be out to the store, which means I'm out drinking. And so that's one way that plan doesn't work. But here's the greater dilemma. As physicians have this idea that they're to be highly concerned with the welfare and health of the patients that they're serving, and so these doctors started slowly shutting me off. But I'm a keen observer of society. One of these doctors had left his prescription pads in a place where I could access them, and I picked a couple of them up because I thought they might come in handy. And I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a pharmacist, but I do write prescriptions. And I started doing that. I thought, really, I'm making life easy on these doctors. They aren't having to phone in the okay. However, everybody didn't see it that way. And when you need the number of prescriptions I needed, you write a lot of them. And I wasn't selling or anything. I was just sort of making sure I had appropriate inventory to meet my needs. But you break any law long enough, if you go out and run that stop sign here leaving Rock Eagle every day, sooner or later there's going to be a policeman there and they'll arrest you. And in essence, that's what happened with me. So I wrote these and I got caught and I hired an attorney and I could have dodged the bullet with a first offender status, but man, I had lost the power of choice with drinking, popping these pills with everything, and I could not stop. And I ended up getting arrested probably within another 2 or 3 months. And what I got charged with, I'm not going to go into all the details, what I got charged with was assault and robbery at a drugstore. And, you know, they asked Jesse James why he robbed banks, and he says, because that's where the money is. Well, I got charged with robbing a drugstore, and I ended up getting an attorney. I got a high-powered attorney. This is one on the Cobb County Square. This is the guy that knew the DA. This is the guy that was law partners with former Governor Roy Barnes, and he did murder trials and things like this, and he says, Robert, you've got some serious problems here. We got to do some things about it. He told me 2 things. One of them was, he says, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can tell you know, I told you I was in and out for a while. My first time to Alcoholics Anonymous was 1991. It was 9 years before I got sober. I was facing serious legal problems, and it was a Sunday. It was a Sunday like this, but it was in January. I went to this meeting in East Cobb, and it was linoleum floors, folding chairs around round tables. I sort of remember what went on. It was Sunday. I think it was the 21st of that year, and it was Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm in AA. I did not feel happy, joyous, and free. That would come much later. But he told me this other thing, and this was really the troubling thing. He says, Robert, these are some serious charges. At this point, we have 4 felony charges. I think I could plea bargain it down to 2. And that's 10 years, and we'll be able to plea bargain that down to 2 to serve. But you're going to prison. I said, prison? I'm a jail guy. I'm not a prison guy, you know? Give me 2 weeks, a month in jail where I can mark those things off the calendar. But I knew I was really in trouble. I started going to AA. The problem was I was going to AA at the direction of a lawyer. I was going there to stay out of jail. The third tradition says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. It would have been great if I had a desire to stop drinking. That's when AA really works. I had a desire to stay out of prison. I'd love to say that I showed up, got a sponsor, took the steps, and I've stayed sober ever since. That's not what happened with me. But what did happen is that was a time when there was overcrowding in the state of Georgia. prisons were full. They looked at what went on, and though there was an assault charge and a robbery charge, I went in there with like a pistol, put your hands up, and the assault was I sort of running over somebody trying to escape. And they said, this is really not a violent crime, and I dodged the bullet. They put me on long-term intensive probation, 10 years of probation, and man, oh man, I was fortunate. And you would think that somebody with that kind of grace would say, I got to do something to stop. You know, meanwhile, we'd been trying to have kids. We ended up looking into adoption just because my wife couldn't get pregnant. That just wasn't going to happen. We looked into adoption, and we found this adoption agency, and we participated in all the things you have to do, home study and all that kind of stuff. And there was an opportunity for us to adopt a baby. This baby was born on April 29th. It was 1987. We got a call a day or so later and said, this baby's down here in Thomasville. Would you like to come down here and pick him up? And I'll never forget, Teresa and I looked at one another. We were happy as can be. We drove down to Thomasville, and you know, if you're pregnant, you sort of have this 9-month plan to get ready. And we got a phone call, and though we were trying to get ready, all of a sudden it was on. We were going down there. And this was one of those times, and I had more than one of these times, where I really said, I'm putting the flag down. I'm pinning this point. I'm going to stop drinking. I'm stop doing all this other stuff I'm doing because I want to be a good father. We drive down there, and I had that commitment as much as every one of you guys has had at some point in your life. We go down and pick up that baby, and I tell you what, I'll never forget picking up that baby, looking in that little boy's face. We named him Stuart Lars Bell. And I mean, it was just a wonderful experience. We put him in that car seat. We drove back to Atlanta. When we got back to Atlanta, my former wife's family was there. My family was there. People I loved, people I cared about, and they cared about us. And yet there's a lot going on around the house. The baby's crying a little bit. Diapers are being changed. And, you know, I get this little bit of what the book talks about, restless irritability and discontentedness. And I know what will give me that ease and comfort is a couple of beers, a couple of drinks. And, you know, I just could not keep that commitment. I did not have a defense. I did not understand what it meant to be powerless. And so though I had every reason in the world to stop drinking there, I couldn't. I just could not. You know, that little boy grew up. I was on probation, but let me tell you, I'd like to say I was on probation and avoided all the problems I was supposed to avoid. But while on probation, I'm not going to go into it, but I found ways to keep doing the kind of things I was doing. I could drink. And let me tell you this, like one time I went to my probation officer, he's in a Peachtree Road Race t-shirt. I'd run the Peachtree Road Race before. Next time I go see him, I'll wear my Peachtree Road Race t-shirt. You know, I sort of helped him identify with me, and he'd do things like I wouldn't have to go see him for 6 months. And so I could continue living the way that I was living. And the threat was to go to jail for 10 years. That's how powerful alcohol is. We say cunning, baffling, powerful. I'm willing to drink at the expense of going to jail, prison, for 10 years. There'd be no plea bargaining. And I keep on drinking. Well, you know, I'm going to roll it on up to where I got sober because that kind of stuff kept going on. I got off probation, which was really good. And here's sort of how I got to my final sobriety date. It was April 2001. The beginning of April, spring break. This little boy had grown up. He's 15 years old. We're down in Tampa, Florida, having a great time. My wife gets a call. She's got to get back to work by Thursday morning. We'd been down there since the Friday before. Plan on staying the whole week. So she comes back. We get back Wednesday night. I meet some guys that I used to drink with on Wednesday night at the Buckhead Saloon. We go out drinking. And I'm thinking she's going back to work. I'll go back to work. I'll save my vacation days. I'm a little bit hungover. But, you know, as an alcoholic, no big deal going to work with a hangover. I got to keep that money flowing in. And so I go to work, and I am not feeling good. But I had a solution to that. It's the same solution I've been using before. And so what I did is I went to my desk, had a cup of coffee, took a handful of these pills, and was sort of walking around at work. And next thing I know, I'm getting this feeling that I've gotten before, and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm trying to make it back to my office. And all of a sudden, it's just boom. And I fall, and I'm sort of shaking and, you know, I've taken too many of those things. And I hear somebody say, robber's down, call 911. They call 911, and I had these vague memories. You know, I'm sort of in this haze of being hauled off to the hospital. And I forgot to bring this up. My employment, I'd done a variety of different things. At this point, I was working at a recreation center for a church. Churches particularly frown on overuse of medication at work. And so we'll see if I can... So I close the loop on that a little bit. Anyway, so I get hauled off to the emergency room. I wake up in the emergency room. You know, you wake up, and this happened more than once. You see bright lights just like this shining on your face, and people with masks, and they're saying stuff like, "Breathe, Mr. Bell, breathe." And thoughts go through your head like, did I have enough fun to rate a trip to the ER? But I'll never forget, they said, when you show up at the ER, you don't have a way to get home. And I had to call somebody to pick me up and take me home. So I call my former wife, Teresa, and I tell her what's happened. And she's been with me through a variety of, times to the hospital, detox before. I hadn't gone through every trip to detox, pick me up at jail, stuff like that. And here's the question she asked me. And when you're getting asked this question, you are about ready to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, "Robert, is there any hope? Is there any hope?" I didn't even know how to answer that question. But she came to the hospital, and I'll never forget, I'd told the nurse what happened. I wanted to save my life. And the doctor's going through the discharge paper. He's got these discharge papers. He's reading. He says, "Mr. Bell, I've read that you took a handful of pills, didn't even count them. Weren't you afraid of an overdose?" And I said, "No, Doc, I'm afraid of that dreaded underdose is what I'm afraid of, I want to have plenty of booze. I want plenty of whatever I got, because that's what I need to just sort of get rid of me so I can be in that point of just away from Robert." And so he shook his head. Guys don't know how to deal with alcoholics, especially when they're untreated, because they'll lie about anything. So I went home. My wife was a really kind woman. I got there, and she had packed a bag for me. And I said, "What's this, Teresa?" She says, "Well, Robert, it's just not fair for you to keep trying to get sober with us. It's not fair to your son, Stuart. It's not fair to your dad. My mom had died about 8 years earlier, and my dad was living with us." So anyway, I ended up being hauled off to this place in East Georgia called Penfield. I got there, and I hadn't detoxed or anything. After about 2 days, I was shaking, and they asked if I detoxed. I said, "No." They sent me off. I ended up in Peachford, ultimately. And while I was in Peachford, a couple of things happened, a couple of things I think is really important. While I was there, members of Alcoholics Anonymous brought a meeting in, and there was three of them sitting at a table. I'll never remember, I was back in the lockup because they wouldn't let me out with the general population, suicide watch, all that kind of stuff. So these men read off the title page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous the story of how many men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Men and women, it's inclusive, recovered. Regain spiritual, mental, and physical health. And it says, actually, how many thousands? Thousands. It's broad-based. From alcoholism, they talked a bit about the disease of alcoholism. Well, now I'm locked up in the mental institute with my friends, and we're making fun of these guys bringing in a meeting. Of course, they get to leave behind the locked doors. We stay locked in. And I don't gain a sense of that at that moment, but, a little bit later I did. But men in Alcoholics Anonymous were doing that 12th step, trying to reach out. And that was one of the first points that I remember since that last detox. While I was there too, a staff member there at Peachford, he came and he took me back to his office, one of those counseling sessions, one of those things they can bill for, and he asked me, he says, "Robert, have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Doesn't everybody go to the Mental Institute to go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Well, many do." He said, "Let me ask you this. Did you ever take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I think every man in this room knows that they've taken the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every man in any AA meeting, they know in their heart of hearts that they've taken the 12 steps. Have they gotten on their knees and done that third step prayer, written an inventory, shared it? Are they out trying to help other people? I knew I had not. I said no. And he asked some other questions. "Did you get a sponsor?" "Well, in name only. Did you read the big book?" And he asked me a question about reading the big book. I told him I had. He said, "What did Bill finally do when he wanted to get sober?" And I couldn't answer that question. And he says, "Well, he went back to the hospital and he told about this plan of rehabilitation that he had for getting sober. And he was talking to other patients and told them that if they wanted to do that, they would have to do the same thing with others." And I hadn't captured that little tidbit of information. And he asked me this question. This is a key question. He says, "Robert, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you?" Well, I'm an untreated alcoholic. I'm ready to answer. He says, "Oh, no, I don't really want to answer." He sent me back to the day room to hang out with the other people. And so these are little memories I have. And I got to ask a question, because it relates to my story, may relate to your story. How many people have actually been to the mental institution? If you raise your hand. Lots of people. How many people have gone to jail or prison? It looks like the same group of people. And if you didn't raise your hand and you hadn't worked the steps, you should probably talk to one of the people who raised their hand, because it could happen to you too. It really could. And it nearly happened to me. So I get out of there, and I go back to this place called Penfield. When I'm there, they say, Robert, you need more treatment. And so they pack me off to this treatment center in Atlanta called MAR. And I went through MAR, and there's people here from MAR. And they sent me to Feeling School. I remember talking to my sponsor a little bit later about that. But the best thing that happened to me was the day I got to MAR, is the guys that I was living with, they're going to a meeting at Peachtree Corners. I went up to Peachtree Corners, and at Peachtree Corners, they have a big book study, they had beginner's meetings, and I went there, and that was my first home group. It became my first home group. And in my second meeting there, I saw the guy that was going to be my sponsor, and he is walking around carrying these two books. He had done the big book meeting on Monday and asked him to be my sponsor. I said, Pat, will you be my sponsor? And he asked me a couple questions. One key thing, he says, Robert, can you stop on your own? And I thought about it, and I thought about all the problems I had. I said, no, I really can't. And he said, that's good. He said, are you willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcoholism? And I said, yeah. So we started meeting. He said, meet me here on Mondays and Fridays. I said, I'll see you at 8. He says, no, meet me at 7. I said, the meeting starts at 8. He says, yeah, but there's things we have to do. We need to make coffee. We need to put up the literature. We hang up the signs of the steps. We put the chairs out. There's a whole host of things we do. When I'd been going to meetings before, I thought church staff did this kind of stuff. What, who am I to know this stuff? When you show up early, show up late, leave early, you don't know what really happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he not only was willing to share his message of recovery through the steps, but he showed me what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he introduced me to people who are sober in AA and people want to get sober in AA. Plus, we started studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We started on the front page and moved through, and that's where I learned that I was powerless over alcohol. I learned about that phenomenon of craving. I learned that I had to concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, but that was the first step of recovery. Moving on through the book, I found that question, that great question, do you now believe, are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? You know, I could answer yes to that, and he told me I was on my way. He had asked me the day I asked him to sponsor me to get on my knees and ask God to help me stay sober. And I said, I don't think God can do that. He said, I didn't ask if you thought God could do that. He said, I asked you to do that. And I started doing it, and thank him at the end of the day. So I'd been doing that for a while. By the time we got to that question, I was ready to say yes. We got to that third step prayer, got on our knees, did the prayer there in the church. He gave me directions that night for the four step, and he knew most of the people that were on the four step because I'd been calling up and complaining every day for about 2 months. And I finished that four step. We did a fifth step at his house, and he let me take an hour to review, to think through the first five proposals. We did step 6 and 7, did that seventh step prayer, and he had a list of amends for me. He said we made it when we took inventory. And so we talked, we read about step 9, we talked about the people, I started that process. And I started making amends. And one before we did steps 10 and 11, we got to page 88. And I'll never forget what Pat told me. I was 4 months sober. He says, Robert, it's time for you to pray to find someone you can help. I said, Pat, what are you telling me? He says, it's time for you to sponsor people. And I was sure this was premature. I was 4 months sober. I'd been to plenty of meetings where they said you have to have a year before you raise your hand. And he told me, you know, Dr. Bob had Bill show up when Bill was only 6 months sober. Bill was 17 days sober when they found Bill D. in the hospital. If everybody waited for a year, none of us would be here, and it's time for you to help the next guy. You have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I wasn't certain, but following his directions had seemed to help. So I started praying for that, and it wasn't soon before I was working with a guy. Now, meanwhile, I'd gotten out of treatment. My dad was ill. He had gotten this infection in his pacemaker, and this infection was causing him to have to be in the hospital long term. He'd been for a couple weeks. And I'll never forget, I went to visit him on a Saturday morning, and my dad told me this. It was about 6:30 in the morning. He says, Robert, there comes a time in every man's life where he has to make peace with God and his fellow man. That's the way he did it. He says he makes peace with God this fellow man. He says, and I've done that, and I'm ready to meet my maker. Well, this is the kind of thing he'd been trying to teach me my whole life, as well as my mother and many other people around me. And, you know, I have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and drive my life into the dirt, get a sponsor who shows me how to take the steps where I get a chance to make peace with God through the amends process, make peace with my fellow man. He says he's ready to make his meet his maker. And you know, that next Tuesday, I was by his bed, along with my wife, along with my son, my brother, and his wife. And he breathed his last. And we were able to be there with him and read things he'd want to hear, read things from the Bible, say prayers, and he died in peace. You know, he was a man that had lived, like all, flawed, but at peace with God. And I was able to participate in the funeral, and that funeral was that Friday. And, you know, I had known my dad for a long time, certainly was able to do the funeral, knew the family members, knew some of his business friends, things like that. So I was able to do the family eulogy. And my son got up and he read the 23rd Psalm, often read at funerals. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Little was I to know that inside of 1 year, we'd be reading the 23rd Psalm at my son's funeral. Stuart was 15 years old. It was July 24th, 2002. I was in my second year of sobriety. And I woke up. My wife came in. She had been out running. She asked me to go downstairs and get Stuart up. He used to go to soccer camp. And I went down the steps. And when I found him, he had completed the suicide act. He had hung himself. And his feet were on the ground. His knees were bent. And I ran over. And I held him. And, you know, there was no first aid to be done, no CPR. And I was sort of in a gray out. I was sober, but I was in a gray out. And I ran up the stairs, and I was screaming, evidently. Teresa jumps out of the shower and says, "Robert, what's happened?" I said, "Stuart's hung himself." And I asked her to call 911, and she did. And I went to my phone, and I called Pat, my sponsor. He says, "Robert, oh my God." I said, "I'll be right over." So he comes over. You know, there's police there because it's a crime scene at that point till they determine the cause of death. Police are there, EMTs, others. Pat's there. And I remember he walked in and he's carrying these same two books like I often saw him carry. We're standing by the coffee pot making a new pot of coffee. And he says, I asked Pat, I said, "Pat, why do these kind of things happen?" And he gives the answer you give in AA. If you hadn't had the experience, he says, "Robert, I don't know." He says, "But I'm here and I'm here to help." And I'm standing there by that window and I look out the window. And a friend who's here, Art S., pulls up on his motorcycle. Matt E. pulls up. Members of my home group and members of the recovery community started pulling up. And you know, Charles Dickens begins a novel that says, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And you can understand why this was the worst of times. The death of a son, a loved son, a wanted son. Death by suicide, complicated death, complicated grief. Why does this happen? It was the worst of times. But let me tell you why, in retrospect, it was the best of times. The members of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, showed up at my house, and they showed us a care and a love that I really can't explain. There was love in people's eyes, love in people's hearts, as they helped us through that day and the days to come. They showed up. And it was a miracle that I cherish as I think back about that time. And in the midst of this, other things happened that, in reflection, are rather humorous. I remember I got a call from this guy's sponsor, Brad. And so I answer the phone, and Brad's calling me, and he's drunk. It's the Thursday, the day after my son has died. And I can't believe it. I say, "Brad, what you really need to do is go to a meeting, pick up a white chip. I've got things I'm dealing with here." And I'm standing by my sponsor, Pat. And Pat looks at me and he says, "Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world." I said, "Pat, my son just died." He said, "Yeah, but if anyone should be drinking, it's you. And you've got a sponsee out there drinking for you." See? It's good to have a sponsor. Sponsors can see things from a different perspective. Now, I didn't feel like the luckiest guy in the world. I look back at that, and that was a rather interesting statement to have made. You know, we took care of the things that needed to be taken care of. People in Alcoholics Anonymous helped us. We buried my son that Friday. And that Friday night, it was birthday night at Peachtree Corners. Somebody was telling their story, and I went back to AA that night. You know, I can remember we took a week off, but I got back, and I started working with guys on a regular basis. I'd been meeting with guys, taking them through the book, and I just kept doing that. And I tell you, I sort of, like in that gray area, those guys were helping me. If I was helping them, really good, but those guys were helping me stay sober. The key thing, when people asked me, they said, "Robert, did you think you're going to drink?" And I can tell you, that day that I found Stuart, I'd gotten up, I'd gotten on my knees, I'd asked God to help me stay sober. I'd read the third step prayer. Let me tell you something else that happened. This was really before AA people showed up. My neighbor had come over, John, and John and Pat and I were sitting at the dining room table. And Pat says, "Robert, get your big book." I'm thinking, John's not an alcoholic. But I get the book. He says, "Open to page 63. He says, "Give it to John." And we did the third step prayer. And I'm going to do it now. And if you know it, as it's written in the big book, repeat it with me. "God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulty, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help, of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. And that prayer was honored that day. Many prayers were honored that day. You know, that's a day that was etched in my mind. But I got back engaged in Alcoholics Anonymous pretty quick. And you know, when you have a death by suicide, there's a lot of stigma attached to suicide. Losing a child is challenging. And there's men in here that have done that, that have had to deal with suicide. Had a chance to visit with Leroy earlier, and we were talking about the loss of our child. And it's complicated to deal with that kind of thing. And I needed help. My sponsor said, the big book says we only know a little. And he said, if you can figure out where to get help. And you know, the day my son died, people told me about opportunities to get more help. So I went to this group. It's called Survivors of Suicide. And it's not led by counselors. It's led by peers, other people that had people die by suicide. And I went to this group, and people said, what you need to do is you need to be able to tell the story. When you can tell the story, you can overcome some of the barriers around denying what's really happened and deal with the emotions. They didn't have 12 steps to work or anything like that, but they had things I needed to do. And, you know, when I think about what happened, I was powerless over what happened with Stuart. And when I think about step two, couldn't believe the power grant ourselves could restore us to sanity, there was a new insanity going on. It would be crazy to think that I'd forever be consumed by the death of Stuart, by suicide. And I had to believe that maybe there was an answer. And the answer was to go and get more help. And so I started participating in this group. And because of you guys, I had learned that I could share, and I talked about it. And after a year or two, they said, Robert, you're doing pretty good here. Maybe you could help us facilitate these groups. We've got a training you could do. So I did that training, and I started helping other people who had died by suicide. And this turned into opportunities to be of service in that arena. And I've had opportunities to speak at conferences around suicide, suicide aftercare, suicide prevention. And I would much rather Stuart be here. But you know, when these things happen in your life, you've got to figure out, what am I going to do about this? How can I make this mess into something where I can be of use to other people? So I've had a chance to participate in Survivors of Suicide. And, you know, I think about my life since then. A year or so after my son died, my former wife and I ended up getting a divorce. Living for 20 years as an active alcoholic is problematic. Loss of a child is problematic. And so we ended up divorced, and she's remarried, and I'm so happy for her. You know, I've been able to make amends. We talk on occasion, like on Stuart's birthday or the anniversary of his death or sometime during that week. And so we're able to stay in touch, and I've been able to remarry. I met a woman in AA, Carrie, and, you know, we're happy. We have built a life together and been married nearly 10 years now. So it's life continues. And I think about my sobriety. There's a lot of things that have happened. You know, since I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got my first job. I've been able to stay employed in continuous employment. And that's sort of a big difference, you know. And the way you do it, if you're new, there's sort of some key things. And it's three things. And if you're new and you haven't been able to stay employed, you might want to get out your pencil. But here's it. Here it is. One, you go to work. Two, you stay at work. And here's the key. You actually work at work. When you can get all three of those going, you got a great shot. And my sponsor told me I needed to do that. So, you know, I talked about all these problems I had. I got charged with all those felonies. And, you know, I get a chance to tell my story here and there. And this guy asked me, he says, have you thought about applying for a pardon? I said, not really. And he says, well, part of the step nine process, you've probably talked with your family, you probably paid back your money, but maybe there's something you owe the state. And so I talked to him about it, talked to my sponsor about it, got a little counsel about it, and I applied for a pardon. This is about 2007. And it goes through the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles, and it took 18 months, which is, I guess, the average efficiency for that type of thing, because they got to look through a lot of things. And so I can remember the date specifically. It was April 9th. It was the day before my sobriety date. And I went out to the post, the mailbox, and in the mailbox was a letter from the Board of Pardon and Paroles. And so I run, grab it. I run out and say, Carrie, you're not going to believe I've got this letter. It's either really good news or it's really bad news. And so I open it up, and sure enough, it was good news. It was a pardon. I got pardoned by the state, signed by the governor. And so I was showing it around. The next day was my sobriety day, and I was waving this thing around. I went and showed it to my sponsor, and he looked over the document rather closely. And I brought it with me because he brought up this one paragraph. It says, Whereas, having investigated the facts material to the pardon application, which investigation has established to the satisfaction of the board, that the pardon applicant is a law-abiding citizen and is fully rehabilitated. He said, they did not talk to me. I'm getting ready to wind up, but I think there's a couple things that I want to think about. You know, if you're new, or for that matter, if you've been around for a while, why is there impeachment? There's that counselor, and I think he is an AA member. And he asked me that question. He said, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you? That's a question I've got for everyone in this room. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you? And I think about a sense of purpose. You know, this is a spiritual meeting, and sometimes our purpose is what shows our spirituality. And the Big Book talks about our real purpose to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and others around us. We're uniquely qualified to help other alcoholics. And I've had an opportunity to help a lot of other alcoholics through sponsorship. I take meetings to DeKalb County Jail. I go to the detox. I've been involved in the Atlanta Roundup. I was involved in the International Convention right here in Atlanta a couple years ago. So I've been able to do a lot of things. But we have an opportunity to be a purpose. And then Stuart dies by suicide. Complicated grief. Challenging. How do you learn to talk about that and deal with that? Maybe I'm supposed to find some sense of purpose in that event that seems so tragic and so off the wall. We all have an opportunity to be a purpose. We all have a position and things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We need to look through our life and see where can we find a sense of purpose. And I heard once, and I think this is a great thing to be said, once you have lived a life of purpose, it's hard to return to the ordinary life. Once you live a life of purpose, it's hard to return to the ordinary life. And lastly, I want you to picture this. Two rooms side by side. There's a room that's pitch black dark. There's not a window. There's no light. It's absolutely dark. Next to it is a room that's lit. There's windows. There's sunlight coming in. And you open the door between the rooms, and the light penetrates the darkness. The light penetrates the darkness. That's what happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I show up here and I have a heart that's encoded in ice. It's covered with resentments and fear, bad behavior, sexual and otherwise. And I meet sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the sunlight of the Spirit etches its way in based on my willingness, based on my willingness to step up to the buffet, like Jewel mentioned earlier, fill my plate, and take some actions. The light can penetrate the darkness. There's one last thing I want to read. I want you to think about that, though. And in fact, here's what I really want you to do. I want you to tell that story to your wife, your friend, someone you live with, someone who hadn't heard that story, because we get a chance here to have the light penetrate the darkness, and it's our job to be the light to those around us. When I was new, I was going to Peachtree Corners, and Bob M., who's in the big meeting in the sky, would do the beginner's meeting. And one of the suggestions he had for newcomers, he'd say, buy the Big Book and buy the 12 and 12, read it and reread it. And I followed that direction. I bought a Big Book, I bought a 12 and 12, and though I really take people through the steps in the Big Book, I love the 12 and 12 as well. And in step 12, it has something certainly pertinent to my story and probably yours as well. And it says, furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeming failure or success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable satisfactions when the brighter, more glittering achievements are denied us? The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep on trying to practice A's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for the many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, they can become facts of life for many more. You know, again, I really believe that my life is better because of the Atlanta Men's Workshop, and I'm better at life because of the Atlanta Men's Workshop. I'm so happy that I could be here with you guys this morning, and Godspeed. Thank you.